Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What were Sigmund Freud's most important contributions to the study of mental health and the treatment of patients, and were they all his own? Although he later minimized the influence of Joseph Breuer on his life and work, Sigmund Freud owed a great deal to the older, more established colleague who supported him both financially and as a professional and personal mentor. Louis Brager is Professor Emeritus of Psychoanalytic Studies at the California Institute of Technology. In the year 2000, he published a well-received biography of Sigmund Freud called Freud, Darkness in the Midst of Vision. His newest book focuses on the fascinating relationship between Freud and Joseph Breuer. It is called A Dream of Undying Fame, How Freud Betrayed His Mentor and Invented Psychoanalysis. Lou, welcome to Think.
Hello.
What were the prevailing ideas about the causes of mental illness in the late 19th century when Freud entered the field?
I think the most prominent idea was something called hereditary degeneracy, just the idea that you had something wrong with your, you know, they didn't call it genes in those days, but, you know, you inherited something and that made you crazy.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of study had been done and theories developed regarding the role of the unconscious and the subconscious in mental health and mental illness at that point?
Well, the idea of the unconscious was really around in Europe in the 19th century, way before Freud. Hypnotism and hypnotic demonstrations have been going on for some decades. Philosophers such as Schopenhauer and so forth had talked about it, but applying it specifically to an understanding of disturbed psychological states or mental illness was really fairly rare.
How are mentally ill patients diagnosed?
In those days?
Mm-hmm.
Really kind of loosely. Diagnoses were sort of just coming into fashion. Hysteria was a kind of a grab bag diagnosis that all kinds of people were given that label, mostly women. You know, it came from an old Greek idea that the womb, from which the term hysteria evolves, broke loose and wandered around the body and lodged in different places where it caused trouble. And absolutely no substance for that idea, but it persisted. All kinds of women who today would be called suffering from post-traumatic stress or a variety of other conditions were just summarily labeled hysteric.
So it was basically an umbrella term for anything that could be wrong with you?
Pretty much, yeah. Again, mostly applied to women. The idea that men could have it also many people questioned. But the fact is many guys who were suffering from war trauma, it was called shell shock then, it certainly became very prominent after the First World War, showed the exact same kinds of symptoms as the women who were labeled hysteric. And we would all, you know, call them today suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
And around the time that Freud began his medical career, what were the most common treatments for people who were labeled hysterical or mad, as the term was as well?
They were application of mild currents of electricity to different parts of the body, rest cures, special diets. The two most prominent ones were one called herbs, electrical treatment, where they applied electrical current to, let's say if you had paralyzed arms or you couldn't walk, they'd apply electrical current to your arms or legs. And the other was the Weir-Mitchell method, in which they did some electrical stimulation and also put people in spas or sanitaria or sent them off to the seashore where they were given rest and special diets and so on.
And there were some sort of drug therapies, but none of them had much basis in fact.
They would prescribe drugs for these people just as they would for others. The chloral Hydrate, for example, was a commonly prescribed sleeping medication. They used laudanum, which I think is an opiate, and people would get addicted to it.
On top of all their other problems.
Made them feel better as long as they were taking it, but then they had to struggle with their addiction, yeah.
So let's talk about Freud. How did he find his way into the study of psychiatry in the first place?
He was doing physiological research in the laboratory of Ernst Brucke at the University of Vienna and seemed to be fairly content doing that, and it had nothing to do with treating patients or psychiatry or anything like that. Hunched over his microscope, dissecting nerve fibers and so on. Eventually he wanted to get married, and Brucke told him, you're never going to get a position here at the university. You'll never make much money. In those days, every field like physiology or biology or pediatrics or whatever had one professor at the university, and everybody else was an assistant. And you had to wait till the professor died before there was an opening again. So Freud was never going to become the professor of physiology. So Brucke advised him to go into private practice, which he did, with a specialty in neurology. And many of the patients who came to a neurologist in those days were people who would today go to a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist. You know, psychiatry was hardly a field in the late 1890s, 1880s, when Freud opened his practice. Most people who were called psychiatrists worked in like mental hospitals dealing with the manifestly insane, schizophrenics and the like. Anybody who wasn't so disturbed that they had to be hospitalized would go to see a neurologist or just their general physician. So Freud would, as a neurologist, would get a lot of people coming to see him who would today be people who'd go to see a psychotherapist.
Just as a little aside here, before he went into psychiatry, Freud had perhaps the most Freudian field of study ever. Can you talk about the first scientific paper that he ever published?
Gosh, I can't remember what it was.
It was
probably about the gonads of the eel.
Of eels, exactly. Okay.
I know that was an early paper. If you say it was the first, it probably was.
Well, you just can't get more Freudian than that.
Right, except all he was doing was looking at nerve fibers under a microscope.
He never expressed to anyone that he had a particular interest in sort of providing aid and comfort to people who were unhappy or ill. That really wasn't his motivation ever, was it?
That's the point I stress in the book. That's why I call it The Dream of Undying Fame. I think he was searching around for something that would make him famous more than, being a physician who was devoted to helping people get better. And since he was seeing a lot of these patients and had glommed on to Breuer's method, the cathartic method of treatment, he began experimenting with different ways in which he thought that would make him famous, both as someone who had a new treatment method and someone who had a new explanation to understand these conditions.
So let's talk about Joseph Breuer. The two met in 1877 when Freud was still a student and Breuer was already well established as a physician.
Right, right. Breuer is 14 years older and was perhaps the most successful family doctor internist in Vienna at the time. Combined a wonderful sort of bedside manner, very empathic, understanding, kindly, with the latest up-to-date scientific knowledge. So I only wish he was in practice here in the Bay Area so I could use him as my family doctor.
And they had certain things in common. They had both probably suffered anti-Semitism in Austria at the time.
Very much so. It was a kind of a mixed bag, anti-Semitism. Austria was traditionally a very anti-Semitic country, perhaps even more so than Germany. We associate, you know, anti-Semitism with Hitler and the rise of Nazism, but Austria had a long tradition of anti-Semitism, as did other countries in Europe. So they did suffer from that. At the same time, Austria was an empire with an emperor and a whole class of royalty, and they didn't like to work, didn't have to work, so that the professions were open to other people. And medicine, for example, was dominated by Jewish doctors. There were probably about 60% of the medical faculty at the University of Vienna Medical School were Jewish. Law, journalism had high percentages of Jews. So there was both anti-Semitism and at the same time tremendous opportunity open to bright young guys, Jewish guys, to succeed in these fields.
So what else do you think it was that drew Breuer and Freud to be such good friends for a time?
Freud was very much looking for an older man, an older successful man who could be a kind of father figure to him. His own father was kind of a weak, failed guy, nice guy, but never got back on his feet financially after he went bankrupt when Sigmund was about 3 and a half. So he was always sort of looking around for someone to idolize, a mentor. Brucke, his professor when he was doing physiological research, was the first of these. Charcot, who he studied with briefly, a famous neurologist in Paris. And he hooked up with Brucke, Breuer, and, Breuer mentored him, introduced him to medical practice, took him on his rounds when he was seeing patients, loaned him money, which he never expected to be repaid, and was in general very kindly and supportive with Freud. And I think he also recognized Freud's brilliance, and it was, you know, he was getting out of this a young guy who could learn from him and talk over medical and psychiatric problems with him.
And they were personally close to the extent that Freud named a daughter after Breuer's wife.
That's right. And dedicated his book On Aphasia to Breuer. Very close in the early years.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about how they came to collaborate on studies on hysteria?
Well, Breuer had treated this young woman named Bertha Pappenheim in around 1880-82 and first applied what he called the cathartic method, which was encouraging the patient to talk freely about all of her symptoms and her feelings connected to the symptoms and so on. Anything else that came to mind, it really was the first version of what later became psychoanalysis and then psychotherapy. This was early on, and Freud, treating similar patients in his practice, got Breuer to describe that case to him several times, and then began to apply the so-called cathartic method in his own work.
Let me stop you there. We'll get more of that story in just a moment. We need to take a quick break.
I hear the music. Okay.
Lewis Breger is my guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Psychoanalytic Studies at the California Institute of Technology. His newest book is called A Dream of Undying Fame, How Freud Betrayed His Mentor and Invented Psychoanalysis. You can get on the line now to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lewis Brager, who is Professor Emeritus of Psychoanalytic Studies at the California Institute of Technology. His newest book is called A Dream of Undying Fame, How Freud Betrayed His Mentor and Invented Psychoanalysis. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. And Lou, before the break, you had started telling us about this woman, Bertha Pappenheim, who went down through the ages as Anna O in the book. People may remember that case.
Right.
And in some ways, it seems that her horrific combination of symptoms made her sort of the ideal touchstone for explaining this new approach to therapy.
True enough. Just for the listener, she had just about every symptom you can imagine. She had paralyses, so-called contractures of her limbs. She had headaches. She went into different mental states where she was sort of in a coma or a dreamlike state and then would come out of it. There were times when she couldn't eat. She was suicidal. She was extremely anxious and depressed a lot of the time. She lost her ability to speak German, and then for a period was spoken a kind of a garble of four different languages, and then could only speak English. So she was indeed highly disturbed with many symptoms, and very difficult to understand what this was all about and where it came from.
So what was Breuer's cathartic method, and how similar was it to what Freud later called psychoanalysis?
The cathartic method was he would meet with her every day, sometimes even twice a day, and encourage her to talk about whatever came to her mind in relation to the symptoms. He started out using hypnosis to put her into a state where she could access this material, but I think mostly gave it up and just had her talk to him. And if she couldn't think of anything to say, he would pick up on something she had been muttering and encourage her to go on from there and just say, talk. All of that was really the beginning of what Anna O herself, or Bertha Pappenheim, called the talking cure, also jokingly referred to as chimney sweeping, getting all the bad stuff out. And that is really the origins of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, getting the person to talk freely about what's disturbing them, and especially emotional expression. That's the definition of Breuer's word catharsis, getting all kinds of feelings expressed openly. By the way, her breakdown occurred when she was sitting by the bedside of her father, who was dying of tuberculosis over about a six-month period. So she was in a very highly stressful situation.
So one of the things that Breuer identified about her was that her unexpressed grief was at least partially responsible for her mental illness.
He was quite clear that it all came about during this situation. He wasn't so clear that it was unexpressed grief, although that certainly is what we would say now. I would say more than that, it was a tremendous ambivalence that she felt towards her father. She was really, he was a very controlling, rigid guy who had founded his own Orthodox synagogue in Vienna. And she was very much coerced into preparing for her life as an obedient Jewish wife. She was brilliant, very imaginative, with a wide range of interest, and all of this was kind of not allowed in her life. Her brother was allowed to pursue a higher education at the university, and she was just given what kind of a finishing school education. And so I think the two things that were operating in her, if we kind of look back from today's perspective on what was troubling her, was one, the complete stifling of all of her intelligence and creativity because she was a woman, and her ambivalence toward her father. She loved him and was very disturbed that he was dying. At the same time, he was the guy who imposed all the constrictions on her that blocked her from, expressing or achieving anything in her life.
One of the ways in which Breuer and Freud differed in their sort of decisions on trying to apply the causes of many of these things was that Freud's explanations for these illnesses tended to be much more sexual than Breuer's. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Breuer says in his account of Anna O, the sexual element was almost completely absent in her. She was very devoted to her father, but seemed to be completely uninterested in other men and in sex. Freud, very, very soon in his earliest treatment of patients, because he was looking for one great big law that would make him famous, this is again the dream of undying fame, he grabbed on to sexuality as his explanation. And he began to see it everywhere, whether it was there or not. Now, it's certainly true that a lot of people had sexual conflicts, and some of them more so in late 19th century Europe than we do today. But he would see it when it wasn't there. If a patient didn't talk about it, he would say that was evidence of their repression of their sexuality. So it really came from his own wish to have a single big theory that could explain everything that would make him famous.
Well, and it also seems, reading this account, that a lot of Freud's own issues were wrapped up in his own sexuality.
Very much, yeah. He was a very sexual repressed guy, a virgin at the time of his marriage at age 30. People think... Well, Europe was a Victorian sexual morality. It was very uptight. But Vienna, where he grew up, was, especially for people of his class and education, they were not religious. They were scientists, rationalists. Many of them were much more open sexually than he was. I think it goes back to... a series of traumatic losses of his mother's care and attention when he was a kid, that he was kind of afraid of women. They made him anxious and had to control them. And sexuality, getting that intimate, that close, was something that he was afraid of.
Well, even his theories about the Oedipus complex, which has been disproven by subsequent science, would seem to relate directly to his own experience.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there's... I think people have Oedipal problems when they come from the parent, not the child. The mother who's overly seductive with her son, or the father or stepfather who's sexually molests his daughter, that creates, I would say, a traumatic situation, but it would sort of fit the Oedipal idea. The idea that it comes from the kid, that the kid has got these Oedipal drives and fantasies for the parent, and that they can't have the parent, is a source of huge conflict and creates neurosis, is simply not true.
But in Freud's case, his mother had lost a child not long after he was born and was sort of consumed by that. And then he had this father that he viewed as a failure who somehow in his mind didn't deserve the affections that his mother gave.
Yeah, the first child born after him died when he was 8 months old, so Sigmund was a little under two, and we can assume that his mother was focused on her grief about the death of this baby. And then there were five more kids born by the time he was 10, five sisters and a brother. So he was constantly being displaced by a new baby and losing his mother's time and affection and attention. In addition, he was cared for by a nurse who he seemed to be quite close to, who was arrested for stealing when he was 2 and a half and put in jail and immediately vanished from his life. So he suffered a lot of really quite traumatic losses of maternal care in his earliest years.
Lou, what can we say definitively about Freud's sexual orientation?
You want me to say he was gay?
Well, I don't know.
Secretly?
He had places where he wrote that he struggled with...
I've become friends with his granddaughter, Sophie Freud, who is a wonderful woman who doesn't buy her grandfather's theories, even though she's in the field herself. And she says, and I would tend to agree with her, that if he were alive in today's climate, he probably would be openly gay. I think he was more sexually drawn to men than to women. Less afraid of them. His relationship with Wilhelm Fliess, if you read those letters, they're just full of effusive, they sound like love letters, a lot of them. Hmm. So, and there are other guys, and his words give that feeling. But he considered it a terrible threat, and he talked about his unruly homosexual libido that he had to struggle to control.
On the other hand, he had other patients, male patients, that he told must be homosexual, even though they didn't recognize it, and they spent years sort of struggling with this and worrying about it when, in fact, they were not gay.
Right, right, which was, I think, a projection of his own inner feelings. Mm-hmm. He thought everybody had these homosexual urges, every man, and that they had to fight against them, struggle against them, and it was a big source of neurotic conflict, where once again, it's simply not true. You know, there's certainly some men, some small number of men, who have that particular conflict. But he made it a universal, as he tended to do with a lot of his ideas.
So what sort of reaction did the medical and the scientific community have to studies on hysteria when it was first published?
Freud likes to portray himself as this lonely, misunderstood pioneer that the establishment rejected and so forth. The fact is there were many people in the field. It didn't become a bestseller, but there were many people in the field who took it up and were enormously impressed with the ideas and wrote very favorably about it. Same with some of his later books. He had this kind of, I guess I would call it a prickly narcissism, where he really required complete praise and complete acceptance. And if you told him, you know, I like 95% of what you're saying, but there's this little 5% that I can't quite agree with, he'd feel, you hate me and you're slandering me and you don't believe me. Hmm. And I think that was kind of his own reaction. The fact is, many very intelligent guys who later became psychoanalysts read the studies on hysteria and his next book, The Interpretation of Dreams, and were very impressed with them and drawn to him as somebody who, for the first time, helped them understand all these patients they worked with and gave them a method to try and work with them.
Freud initially sort of gave Breuer full credit for having pioneered cathartic therapy and for sort of recognizing the role of the unconscious mind and finding new ways to treat people. How did that start to change?
That's really an interesting question. In his 1909 Clark lectures, the one time he came to the United States, he does... it was not me who invented this, it was Breuer, and he gives him full credit. By 1915, he's in on the history of the psychoanalytic movement, he's saying, I'm really the one who invented psychoanalysis. And then he does something that he was to do with all kinds of people over the succeeding years. He essentially invents a story that toward the end of their treatment, Bertha Pappenheim, Anna O's, manifested a so so-called hysterical pregnancy, and Breuer was called back, and she told him, "I'm giving birth to Breuer's baby." And he was so scared, he ran away. Breuer was so scared, he ran away and went off on a second honeymoon with his wife, where his daughter was conceived, and she later committed suicide in New York, which I don't know what that's supposed to have to do with it, but it seemed like some fitting ending to Breuer's cowardness, inability to deal with sexuality. A lot of people have done some good research about this and found out that it's simply not true. It's all made up by Freud and elaborated by Ernest Jones, his loyal biographer. Breuer didn't run away. He kept treating her for a couple of years later. The daughter was not conceived at that time. She was conceived earlier when he was still treating Bertha Pappenheim, and she didn't commit suicide in New York, but was killed by the Nazis in 1942 because she stayed in Vienna. So it's just that story has passed into psychoanalytic lore, and people trained in the old psychoanalytic method sort of absorbed it as the truth and went around repeating it.
Did Freud and Breuer have a falling out specifically, or did they just sort of fall apart from each other?
I think Freud turned on him. Breuer was really kind of stunned by why this had happened. And it really had to do with Breuer not willing to go along with this grand sexual theory that sex was the explanation for all neuroses. He made a couple of statements in public lectures about, Freud has made enormous contributions in sexuality, and sexual conflict is certainly very important in many cases, but it's not the explanation for every case. Well, that was it for Freud.
Louis Breger is my guest.
I hear our music.
We have the music. We'll be back in just a minute. Louis Breger is my guest. His new book is called A Dream of Undying Fame, How Freud Betrayed His Mentor and Invented Psychoanalysis. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor Emeritus of Psychoanalytic Studies at the California Institute of Technology, Louis Breger. His newest book is called A Dream of Undying Fame, How Freud Betrayed His Mentor and Invented Psychoanalysis. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. I guess going back to your title here, Lou, I have to ask if the reason that Freud became a household word, whereas Breuer is sort of more left to history, is the fact that Freud really wanted to be famous.
That's it. He worked hard at it. I would add, he was a brilliant guy, and many of his ideas were correct, held up, and were innovative. He was also an enormously persuasive writer, unlike a number of the other people who, we think of as the early psychoanalysts, Alfred Adler, Carl Jung, and so on, who were not very good at writing. Freud, after they were personally not on the scene, their ideas tended to fade, whereas Freud's writing very persuasive and has lasted and impressed many people.
It's hard, though, not to read this account and wonder how much faster the field of psychiatry and psychology might have progressed had we not had to spend decades sort of deconstructing some of the more off-base theories that Freud made sort of common knowledge.
Right. Hard question to know, to answer. Once again, you know, he did have a lot of good ideas, and so in that sense, the field benefited from them. But we've also been stuck with a lot of the ideas that he was just adamantly committed to because they were all wrapped up with his ideas of being famous.
Breuer lived until the mid-20s. How did Freud's betrayal affect his professional career?
Oh, not in the least, I don't, as far as I know. He was very well established as a practicing doctor and as a research scientist, and he just went back to those, to doing, he never gave it up, but he sort of just concentrated on it, and as far as we know, his practice was solid, and one of his major research interests was the role of the inner ear and ear in balance, and he went back to working on that and corresponding with other scientists about it. So I think the blow to him was more personal. There's a story which I recount in the book of some years later, after Freud had dropped him, you know, Vienna lived close by, and they had a lot of professional colleagues in common, so they could have easily kept up their relationship and seen each other, but they didn't, Freud didn't. They encountered each other by accident, walking in the streets of Vienna, and Breuer spontaneously opened his arms in greeting to Freud, because he had been very fond of him, mm-hmm. and Freud walked by pretending not to see him.
That's awful.
Which was typical. If you crossed him, if you didn't support him in every particular, you became an enemy in his eyes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, I got on so fast.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. I saw a movie recently called When Nietzsche Wept, and it implied this entire relationship Freud with his mentor, but it also dealt with Nietzsche and Freud's relationship and implied that a great deal of the understanding that Freud had of the unconscious came from his interactions with Nietzsche, and I was just curious if this was something that was known before. I've never heard of it.
I didn't see the movie. Actually, I read the book. It's by a guy named Irving Yalom, who's out here in Northern California. Freud claims in his writings that he didn't read Nietzsche and was not influenced by him, that he wanted to keep his mind unsullied by the ideas of other philosophers and so forth. Subsequent research into his library shows that he had volumes of Nietzsche with notes in the margin, which indicated that he had read him and he was familiar with him. I don't think that Nietzsche was very much of a specific influence on Freud's ideas. As I mentioned earlier today, the idea of the unconscious was really around in many European thinkers' minds in the 19th century, and Nietzsche, of course, being the most prominent one.
One thing that I guess Freud and also Breuer helped to do was to dispense with the technique of using hypnosis to try and sort of help people free their unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clear in Breuer's relationship with Bertha Pappenheim that he says she's just not suggestible. She's too strong-willed, so he doesn't use hypnosis that much. In the first Freud case that is in the studies on hysteria and that I talk about in my book, a woman he calls Emmy von N, whose real name was Fanny Moser, he uses hypnosis almost exclusively. Freud uses it almost exclusively to sort of put her in a hypnotic state and tell her when she wakes up her symptoms will be gone. It's a sort of direct suggestion. And he gives that up, and you can see that in the succession of cases that he presents in the studies on hysteria. and moves to just letting the patient talk about whatever comes to their mind. So it's in that book and in that series of patients, you see the evolution away from hypnotic suggestion to something like psychoanalysis, psychotherapy as we know it today.
And this patient, Emmy von N., Fanny Moser, was dealing with split personality. Is that right?
I would say she was an extremely traumatized, dealing with a kind of a post-traumatic state, which part of which is a severe dissociation or split in the personality. I thought that case was really quite amazing. Here is a woman who suffers enormous numbers of deaths in her family as she's growing up. 9 of her 13 siblings died. She comes home when she's 19 to find her own mother dead on the floor from a stroke. And when she's in her early 20s, she's married to an older man and is in bed having given birth to her second child when he drops dead of a heart attack right in front of her face. So as if, you know, that's enough to, I think, be traumatic to almost anybody. Freud reports all that, and then he can't help speculating about the role of sexuality in creating her neurosis, and says, you know, she's got no outlet for her sexuality, or she's sexually repressed. The fact, because he says that, because she doesn't talk to him about it. The fact is, she was very sexually active. She was a very wealthy woman, and she had a lot of lovers throughout her life. But she didn't marry again, because if she did, they would have had access to all of her money that she inherited from after her husband died.
How candid was Freud in reporting the ultimate outcomes of the patients that he treated?
You know, he's pretty honest in some ways. Most of his best-known cases, the long case reports that he wrote that are sort of used to be taught in psychoanalytic institutes and so on, did not have good outcomes. There are a few where the outcomes were uncertain when he exaggerated a little bit, but mostly, if you read them closely, even in his own words, they did not have good outcomes.
There's some really interesting information in here about the way he practiced. One little bit of trivia is the reason that Freudian psychoanalysis takes place with a patient lying on a couch and the doctor behind is mostly about, again, one of Freud's neuroses. He didn't want to sit there looking at somebody for 8 hours a day.
Right. That's his own words. He didn't like being, quote, stared at for 8 hours a day. You know, what's the problem? There are many of us who have practiced therapy for many years who sit face-to-face and don't find it a problem. I think, as a matter of fact, it's quite helpful if you're engaged in a communication with someone where they're revealing their most powerful feelings and their conflicts and so on. It's really helpful to be able to see their facial expressions, for them to be able to see you and so on. So I think the couch, which has become a kind of symbol for therapy, is really just a carryover of Freud's own discomfort.
And there were other sort of rules that he had for the way that patients should be treated that, in fact, he didn't always follow himself.
Right, right. He describes what you should do as an analyst, as you should behave like a surgeon, you should be neutral, you should not reveal anything about yourself, you should respect confidentiality and so on. He almost never did that. It's a wonderful article by two psychiatrists from Harvard, which they've reviewed all cases of Freud's in which there's any evidence, and they show in almost none of the cases does he follow his own rules.
And the outcomes for patients when he didn't follow the rules tended to be better than otherwise.
That's right. Sometimes, anyway. It didn't help people if he was gossiping about them to other patients or to colleagues, but a lot of the times when he was open, friendly, not so neutral or behaving like a surgeon, it was more helpful to people.
Did it hurt his reputation at all that for a time at least he was sort of an enthusiastic proponent of cocaine use?
It was kind of covered up until much later, so that during the heyday of his success and the founding of the psychoanalytic movement and all of that, it really wasn't well known. It was only later that it came to light. It's not known for how long he took it. It's possible he used it for as long as 15 years. He did seem to be one of these people who could take it and not become completely addicted, where you have to keep upping the dose to get the effect. But he did indulge himself in that.
This seems a strange question to ask, but how self-aware was Sigmund Freud?
Not very. Not very. He was aware of some things, and the truth about himself would peek through from time to time, but for the most part, I think not very.
Did he seek professional help for any of his own neuroses?
Oh, no. He was completely resistant to it. He claimed that he had carried out this self-analysis using his own dreams at the end of the 19th century, and he'd gotten everything all worked out, and there was no need for any more. People like Ferenczi, who was one of his loyal followers, and used to go on vacation together. Ferenczi was a kind of very emotional, open guy. Would offer to, that they should analyze each other and so on, and Freud would have none of it.
So, Lou, so much has been disproven about Freud's ideas about the nature of sexuality and how it affects human behavior, but he did give the field of psychiatry some very important foundations. Can you just sort of elaborate those for us?
Sure. First of all, there's the method itself, what Breuer first called the talking cure, what Freud called psychoanalysis. There would probably be no psychotherapy of any kind if it weren't for them starting that. So that was enormously important. The idea of the unconscious, that we're not really aware of the patterns that we have in us from our childhood and so on, again, a very valuable idea. The idea of the importance of childhood relationships shaping our personality. While he was wrong about the specifics, like the Oedipus complex, just the general model was of enormous value and has been followed up by all kinds of people.
Louis Breger's new book is called A Dream of Undying Fame, How Freud Betrayed His Mentor and Invented Psychoanalysis. Lou, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.